to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today, Monday, December 7th, Pearl Harbor Day. I'm your reader, Ken Lauder. First, let's take a look at the weather for eastern Iowa. Today, we're expecting a partly cloudy day with winds from the west, which will be light all day. Cedar Rapids will see a high of 40. We'll see 41 here in Iowa City, falling to a low tonight of 25 in Iowa City and 26 in Cedar Rapids. Sunset tonight is at 4:35 p.m., sunrise tomorrow morning at 7:22 a.m., for a total daylight period of 9 hours and 13 minutes. And now from the front page of today's Gazette, new sheriff in town in Johnson County. A story by Lee Hermiston of the Gazette staff. For the first time in 16 years, Johnson County will have a new sheriff after winning 4 straight terms and never being opposed after his initial victories in the 2004 Democratic primary and general election, outgoing Sheriff Lonnie Polkrovic likely could have stayed on for another term. But Polkrovic said he wanted to follow the lead of his 2 predecessors and retire after 4 terms. "Do you want someone staying in office forever?" he asked. "I thought it was time to go." After he announced his retirement, Polkrovic launched a bid for the Iowa House District 73 seat, but he lost to incumbent Republican Bobby Kaufman in the November 3 election. Taking Polkrovic's place as Johnson County's new sheriff will be Detective Sergeant Brad Kunkel. After defeating Al Fear in this year's primary, Kunkel cruised to an uncontested victory in the general election. Now Kunkel said he's ready to lead and deliver on his campaign promises. "I'm just so thankful and grateful to the public, grateful the public has faith in me," Kunkel said. "They had the faith in me and they support the sheriff's office. That's because of the hard work of past administrations and the good job that everybody who works here does every day." Polkrovic announced his retirement May the 1st, 2019, and effectively endorsed Kunkel that day on Facebook. Kunkel, in turn, announced his candidacy shortly after. But Kunkel was not just handed the endorsement, both men say. Kunkel said he's been preparing to possibly follow in Polkrovic's footsteps for at least a decade through seeking educational opportunities and involving himself in the community. Polkrovic said he and Kunkel talked about his interest in becoming sheriff one day, but Polkrovic said he wanted to wait before endorsing. "I wanted him to work as hard for the office as I did to show the people he really wanted it," Polkrovic said. "He worked his tail off. He just made himself the logical choice to succeed me. The result is a much smoother transition than when Polkrovic prepared to take office 16 years ago. After a contentious primary and election in 2004, the previous administration didn't make an effort to ease Polkrovic into office," he recalls. "There wasn't any communication or transition, really," he said. "I was allowed to work days and work on stuff I wanted to work on, but there was no sort of transition, no smooth handoff." Aside from seeking his first and second deputies, Polkrovic said, "The lack of transition left questions unanswered and decisions couldn't be made. He couldn't work on the budget for the office he would be leading." This time around, Kunkel said he's been working closely with Polkrovic and the outgoing administration, gleaning institutional knowledge and insights along the way. Kunkel said he's worked with Polkrovic and his team on hiring, promotions, and other staff changes necessary with his ascension to sheriff. The sheriff's job pays about $150,000 a year. Lieutenant Randy Lamb will serve as Kunkel's chief deputy, and Sergeant Matt Hendricks will serve as second deputy, creating a domino effect in terms of hiring and promotions. Kunkel already has presented his proposed budget to the Board of Supervisors. "I think it sets up the office for a better transition period," Kunkel said. "It's been wonderful to have this opportunity to work through the end of their careers." Polkrovic said that collaborative transition benefits the public. "It's a really big deal," he said. "Having a smooth transition where the public knows we're not lacking a bunch of detectives or a bunch of command staff, a smooth transition just makes a big difference for everyone involved, including the people we serve. It's the people, those he had worked with and those he served, that Polkrovic said he'll miss the most. He joined the sheriff's office in 1985. All I ever wanted to do since I was a kid was be a cop, he said. When I became sheriff, I really was no longer a cop on the street. I missed those days of being out on patrol, having interactions with people, helping people, things like that. Polkrovic said he's proud to have modernized the sheriff's office, adding mobile data terminals and dash cameras to every squad car, and outfitting deputies with body cameras. During his tenure, he championed the creation of the county's Joint Emergency Communications Center and helped hire the first jail alternatives director. Polkrovic also was involved with the Iowa State Sheriffs and Deputies Association, serving as president of the organization. Without hesitation, Polkrovic listed the failed attempts to fund a new Johnson County jail or justice center as his biggest regret. He's convinced that a new jail still is sorely needed, but he'll be leaving it up to Kunkel to decide how to address that. Obviously, right now during the pandemic, our inmate numbers are down, and we're keeping them down, he said. Everything is different. It's hard to say where that will go. Kunkel said at some point the county and its residents will have to decide the best use of its tax dollars. Band-aid fixes for the nearly 40-year-old jail or a new facility. We'll have to revisit it again at some point, he said. Our jail alternatives has obviously been very successful, and we're doing what we can to provide those alternatives and look at other ways to provide services. While those work well, we can't lose sight of the fact that crime does still happen, and we still need to protect victims. The need for the jail hasn't gone away, and the desire to have a safe and efficient jail is of the utmost importance. Kunkel's two top campaign goals were the creation of a domestic violence response protocol and hiring another deputy to free up a detective to assign to a computer forensics task force. There's also the matter of responding to the continuing COVID-19 pandemic and societal changes brought on by this summer's Black Lives Matter movement. Kunkel said the sheriff's office already has in place many of the changes protesters were seeking. He plans to continue a commitment to best practices in law enforcement. It's reassuring to know that Johnson County, Iowa, continues to be a leader in a lot of areas, he said. I am confident that we can continue to lead in those efforts. Last Thursday, Polkrovic was still in the office he'll occupy for a few more weeks. Reflecting on old calls of service and reading Christmas cards sent years ago by supporters, he said he plans to just take it easy for a while when he leaves. I want to believe that the people were happy and satisfied with the job we were doing, he said. It really is a job that's for the people and of the people. If the people are unsatisfied, they'll make a change and they'll do it at the voting booth. For them not to want to change, for them to continue selecting my name is a real honor. It's just been one of the biggest honors of my life to serve in this position. Next, we have a story that's not local. It's from the Washington Post, but it's of vital interest to everyone here in eastern Iowa. It's entitled, Vaccine Could Be Authorized This Month. The leader of the White House's effort to develop a coronavirus vaccine has predicted that by the end of January, there will be a significant decrease in deaths among the nation's elderly as high-risk populations in the United States receive vaccinations. Moncef Slaoui, chief science advisor to Operation Warp Speed, said he expects independent advisors to the Food and Drug Administration to recommend emergency authorization for the vaccine developed by Pfizer and German biotechnology company BioNTech when the panel meets Thursday. The FDA is expected to issue the authorization soon after that. Pfizer's vaccine is the first in line for approval in the United States. Biotechnology company Moderna also has filed for emergency authorization of its coronavirus vaccine. Health and Human Services Secretary Alex Azar said that if the FDA panel recommends authorization of the Pfizer vaccine later this week, people could start receiving shots within days. But assuming any coronavirus vaccine is authorized, it will take months before vaccinations have any effect on the state of the pandemic in the United States, which is facing a dire surge in cases. Daily infections and hospitalization levels are reaching new highs, and deaths are climbing, as experts warn that the worst days still might lie ahead. Hospitals already slammed could see worsening numbers in the coming weeks as a result of interactions during Thanksgiving, experts warn. A federal advisory panel recommended last week that the first coronavirus vaccine doses be given to an estimated 21 million healthcare workers and 3 million residents and staff in nursing homes and other long-term care facilities. During an interview on CBS News Face the Nation, Slawi said that vaccinations might start to have an effect on infection counts for the most susceptible people in January and February. In a separate interview on CNN's State of the Nation, he predicted that most of the highly susceptible population, about 100 million people, could be covered by vaccines by the middle of March. I'm hopeful that by the end of the month of January, we should already see quite a significant decrease in the mortality and severe morbidity associated in the elderly population, he said on CNN. There are, of course, many other people, unfortunately, that have comorbidities that live outside of care facilities that it will take more time to immunize them. Slawi also countered recent criticism from President-elect Joe Biden that the Trump administration doesn't appear to have a detailed distribution plan for the vaccine. He said Biden's transition team has not yet been briefed on all plans. We haven't had any meetings yet, he said on CBS News. I know we have a meeting this coming week, and we really look forward to it, because actually things have been really very appropriately planned. In an interview on Fox News Sunday, Azar called Biden's criticism nonsense. We have comprehensive plans from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, working with 64 public health jurisdictions across the country, the HHS secretary said. We are leveraging our retail pharmacies, our hospitals, our public health departments, our community health centers. We have the McKesson-built kits that have the syringes, the diluent, the needles, the PPE needed to administer. This is being micromanaged and controlled by the United States military, as well as our incredible private sector. Slawi praised Biden's plans to ask Americans to commit to wearing masks for the first 100 days after he enters the White House. I think it's a good idea. It's never too late. The pandemic is ravaging the country, he said. We all need to take our precaution, wear our masks, wash our hands, keep our distance, remain aware that this virus is a killer. Slawi added that there is light at the end of the tunnel, but we will not all have the vaccine in our arms before May or June, so we need to be very cautious and vigilant. Deborah Birx, coordinator of the White House Coronavirus Task Force, similarly urged people not to let their guard down amid news of a coming vaccine. I want to be very frank to the American people. The vaccine is critical, but it's not going to save us from this current surge, Birx said on NBC News Meet the Press. Only we can save us from this current surge, and we know precisely what to do. So if you have loved ones that you want to protect, you have to follow these guidelines now. Also from the front page, Cedar Rapids police find a new way to help kids stay warm. A story by Kat Russell of the Gazette staff. If 2020 were a typical year, officers with the Cedar Rapids Police Department would be preparing for their annual Santa Cop event, during which officers take children from about 100 families shopping for winter items and a little something fun. The program is sponsored by the Cedar Rapids Police Protective Charity, which pays for the items via donations, and officers give their time to help children shop for needed cold weather items, including coats, snow boots, gloves, and winter hats. Santa Cop started about 17 years ago with a few officers who saw a need and funded the shopping spree themselves, said Charity Hansel, Cedar Rapids mental health officer. Now the event has grown to include two events, one during the holiday season and another Shop with a Cop event at the end of summer for back-to-school supplies with dozens of officers and hundreds of kids. But 2020 has not been a typical year. Because of the COVID-19 pandemic, the department called off Santa Cop. Hansel recently spoke with the Gazette about how officers still found a way to get winter goods to area kids. Question: can you talk about the decision to call off the Santa Cop event? Answer: absolutely love doing the Santa Cop event. We love seeing the children and we want to develop those relationships. That was the whole point of the program. But at the same time, we knew because of COVID that we couldn't. It just wasn't safe. We didn't want to put the officers in that environment. We didn't want to put the kids and their families in that environment. And we didn't want to put the employees at Target at risk. So we voted unanimously to find some other way to contribute. Question: what did you end up doing? Answer: at about the same time that we, the board, decided we couldn't do the Santa Cop program, KCRG was doing their Coats for Kids event. So I reached out to them to see if there was a way we could help with them with that program. The Cedar Rapids Police Protective Charity had $10,000 earmarked for the Santa Cop event, so we thought maybe we could donate that money to Coats for Kids. The catch was that I wanted to make sure our donations went to local kids, and the Coats for Kids event reaches something like 19 counties on the eastern side of Iowa. But since we were planning to donate such a substantial amount, we were able to designate that the coats we purchased stayed local, and I think the event ended up raising more than $40,000 in total, which is great. Question: about how many coats were purchased with the Cedar Rapids Police Protective Charity funds? Answer: we were able to purchase 500 coats, but we didn't want to just give the money and be done. We wanted to be involved. So when the coats were ordered and delivered, officers helped tag and bag all of the coats. And then they helped deliver the coats to the Salvation Army and a couple of other places. And then the officers helped staff those places when the coats were given out. It was kind of a drive-through type situation, so we could minimize contact with the families, but still make sure we could get the coats to the kids. And we ended up with some leftover coats. Question: what will you do with the leftover coats? Answer: we have about 100, maybe a few more, coats left, and they will be brought over to the police department in the next few days. We know that there are still kids out there that need coats, and so we want the community to know that anyone who still needs a coat for their child to please contact me directly here at 319-286-5406. I'll read that number again. It's 319-286-5406, and I will make sure that a coat gets delivered to that child. Question: do you have any other thoughts about this year's adaptation? Answer: there were pluses and minuses to the decision to not do Santa Cop. A plus is that we reached a lot more kids in 2020 by joining with Coats for Kids, but we would much rather have had that personal contact if we could. We knew it was going to be different, but we really wanted to make sure that families knew that we still care about them, and we know that there's a need, and we want to help with that. And it was hard on us to miss out on that contact with the kids. It's a big deal for us to be around kids and to form those relationships. So it stinks that we missed that opportunity not once this year, but twice. The department's back-to-school shopping event also was canceled because of COVID. But we're going to keep doing what we do. We're going to keep raising money, and we're going to keep reaching out to the kids. And hopefully, we'll return back to some sort of normalcy in time for next fall. And that's really what we're hoping and praying for. And in COVID news, Iowa reports 17 more virus deaths, a story by John McLaughlin of the Gazette staff, days before Governor Kim Reynolds' latest emergency health order is set to expire. Iowa's COVID-19 death rate and new hospitalizations declined Sunday from recent records, but still are far higher than the peak of last summer's surge. According to state public health data, Iowa confirmed 17 more COVID-19 deaths Sunday morning, bringing the total number of Iowans known to have died from the disease to 2,682 in less than 9 months. With that daily toll is far, while that daily toll is far less than the record highs confirmed in recent days, Iowa has added 307 virus deaths in the last 7 days alone. Most of those most recently confirmed to have died from COVID-19, 11 of the 17, were over 80 years old, according to the data, underscoring how older people are most vulnerable to complications from the disease. The other 6 were of people ages 60 to 80. 11 counties recorded deaths. Pottawatomie reported 5, and Black Hawk reported 3. Bremer, Butler, Floyd, Johnson, Keokuk, Lynn, Marion, Polk, and Webster counties each added 1 death. Lynn County also added 77 positive cases Sunday morning, for a total of 14,994. Johnson County added 41 cases, for a total of 9,991. In all, Iowa added 1,869 new cases in the 24-hour period ending at 11 a.m. on Sunday. The state said that was based on 5,418 test results, 3,549 of which were negative or inconclusive. The new additions bring the state's total number of coronavirus cases since the pandemic was confirmed in Iowa in March to 243,930. The number of people being treated for the virus in Iowa hospitals continued several days of declines on Sunday, albeit from record highs. Hospitalizations dropped from 960 to 918 in the 24-hour period. The number of patients in intensive care dipped from 204 to 195, but those requiring ventilators to breathe rose from 117 to 122 in the period. The latest emergency public health requirements ordered by the governor are set to expire Thursday, unless changed or extended. Among other things, the order prohibits indoor gatherings of more than 15 people for events, including weddings and funerals, and limits such gatherings held outdoors to 30 people. The order requires that when people gather in an indoor public space that are unable to socially distance for 15 minutes or longer, masks are required. It also orders bars and restaurants to close by 10 p.m. And from the Iowa Today section, Grassley and Ernst call close House race, but neither say Joe Biden won the presidency. Republican U.S. Senators Chuck Grassley and Joni Ernst say fellow Republican Marionette Miller Meeks won her election to Congress, but they have not yet reached the same conclusion about whether Democrat Joe Biden won the race for president. Grassley and Ernst last week reacted to news that Democrat Rita Hart plans to challenge Iowa's 2nd Congressional District close election results. Grassley and Ernst's statement was headlined "Miller Meeks Won Her Election," and criticized the Hart campaign for challenging the results in the Iowa House instead of in Iowa courts. Miller Meeks has been certified as the second district winner in a race that was decided by just 6 votes out of nearly 400,000 cast. Both the original vote count and recount confirmed Mary Annette Miller Meeks won her election, the joint statement from Grassley and Ernst said. There are legal avenues through which candidates can litigate election disputes if they believe there are specific election irregularities. Rita Hart declined to take legitimate legal action in Iowa courts and instead chose to appeal to Washington partisans who should have no say in who represents Iowans. That's an insult to Iowa voters and our nonpartisan election process. We are confident in the fairness and accuracy of Iowa's election system. In the meantime, neither Grassley nor Ernst has stated that President-elect Joe Biden won the presidential election, which was called almost a month ago by margins exponentially larger than Miller Meeks' apparent victory. Neither Grassley nor Ernst suggested President Donald Trump, a Republican, should stop challenging the election results in myriad states. When asked why Grassley and Ernst were quick to declare Miller Meeks the winner of a race decided by 6 votes, while still being unwilling to declare Biden the winner, a spokesman issued a joint response from the senators supporting Trump's efforts in the courts. Their argument is that Trump should be allowed to pursue legal options through the courts, and that's what Hart should have done instead of taking her challenge to the U.S. House, which is controlled by Democrats. President Trump, like all candidates, is entitled to pursue legal challenges in the courts to litigate alleged violations of election law, the joint response said. Unfortunately, Rita Hart declined that opportunity and is now attempting to circumvent Iowa courts by appealing directly to Nancy Pelosi and House Democrats to undo a verified and certified election outcome. Washington politicians should not decide who represents Iowans. Hart's campaign has argued it believes there are thousands of ballots that should be reviewed in the second district election, and that Iowa state law does not allow for sufficient time to conduct such a lengthy review. But what the Grassley and Ernst response ignores is that the Trump campaign's legal efforts have been decidedly unsuccessful, according to a reporting from the Associated Press. Trump's campaign and his allies have brought about 50 cases. Only one has been successful, which was a minor victory in Pennsylvania that did not affect the vote totals, while more than 30 cases have been rejected or dropped. Some of the judges' rulings have been harshly worded because of the lack of evidence. In other words, there was no widespread voter fraud, as Trump and his allies contend, without evidence. And you're listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today, Monday, December 7th, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. And first from Amanda, Alberta Ivadel Becker Voles, age 98, passed away peacefully on December 3rd at Colonial Manor. Due to COVID-19, a private family service will take place at St. Michael's Catholic Church in Norway with a burial at St. Michael's Cemetery in Norway. And from Shellsburg, Donald Donnelly, age 82, passed away peacefully on Saturday, December 5th at Rock Ridge Care Center in Shellsburg. Funeral services will be held at 10:30 a.m. Wednesday, December 9, at the Phillips Funeral Home Chapel at 212 East 6th Street in Vinton. Interment will be held at Urbana Memorial Cemetery. Friends may call from 4 to 7 p.m. Tuesday at the funeral home. From Anamosa, Mary Ann Dunkel, age 78, died Thursday, December 3, at Unity Point Health St. Luke's Hospital in Cedar Rapids. Private services will be held for the family on Tuesday, December 8, at the Getch Funeral Home in Anamosa. From Belle Plaine, Minnie Bell Risner, age 100, passed away peacefully at the Keystone Care Center on December 5th. A private family graveside service will take place at the Keystone Cemetery. From Decorah, Gloria J. Carpenter, age 92, died on Wednesday, December 2nd at Wellington Place in Decorah. Private family services will be held in the future, and burial will be in the Phelps Cemetery in Decorah. From Cedar Rapids, Larry T. Finley, age 76, died at his home. A celebration of life service will be held at a later date. Iowa Cremation is in charge of arrangements. From Cedar Rapids, James, also known as Jim Morgan, a.k.a. also known as Hayden Fry of Cedar Rapids, passed away on Thursday, December 3, at Mercy Hospital from complications of COVID-19. There will not be a service per Jim's request. And from Cedar Rapids, Stanley Uthoff, age 92, passed away peacefully on Saturday, December 5, at the West Ridge Residential Care Center in Cedar Rapids. Funeral services will be held at 2 p.m. Thursday, December 7, at Phillips Funeral Home Chapel at 212 East 6th Street in Vinton. Interment will be at Garrison Cemetery with graveside military rites. Friends may call from 1 to 1:45 p.m. Thursday at the funeral home. And from Cedar Rapids, Robert, also known as Bob Davidson, on Wednesday, December 7, a loving husband and father, Robert C. Davidson, passed away at age 77. Memorial services with military honors will be held at 1:30 p.m. Thursday, December 10, at the Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Cedar Rapids. And from Cedar Rapids, Marilyn Jane Zvacek passed away at her home the morning of December 5 with her husband at her side. Private celebration of life services for Marilyn will be on Wednesday, December 9, the First Presbyterian Church near Ely presiding. The service will be recorded live and a link will be available for all to view on Marilyn's obituary page on www.broschchapel.com. And from Dundee, Donald Dean Gibbs, age 85, passed away on Sunday, December 6, at his home. A private family graveside service will be held on Wednesday, December 9, at the Forestville Cemetery in Dundee. A visitation is from 3 to 6 p.m. Tuesday, December 8, at the Leonard Muller Funeral Home in Manchester, and interment in Forestville Cemetery in Dundee. From Cedar Rapids, Annette Lutz, age 52, died Thursday, December 3. Private family service at 10:30 a.m. Thursday, December 10, at the First Lutheran Church in Cedar Rapids. From Grinnell, Robert, also known as Dwayne Poppenhagen, age 92, passed away peacefully on Monday, November 16, at the Bellevue Medical Center in Bellevue, Nebraska. The family will have a private memorial service in December. And from Guttenberg, Jerry Guder, age 79, died Saturday, December 5, at the Guttenberg Care Center. Arrangements are being handled by the Toik Allen Funeral Home at 207 South 1st Street in Guttenberg, Iowa. There will be a private family graveside service. From North Liberty, Michael Dean Alber, age 71, passed away on September 30 in Florida following a more than decade-long battle with pancreatic cancer. From Lisbon, William Lee Lighthall, age 73, died on Friday, December 4, at Unity Point St. Luke's Hospital in Cedar Rapids. A funeral service is at 11 a.m. Wednesday, December 9, at the Stuart Baxter Funeral and Memorial Services in Mount Vernon, Iowa. A visitation is from 9 to 11 a.m. Wednesday at the funeral home, burial in Mount Vernon Memorial Cemetery in Mount Vernon. From Loudoun, Jack H. Peterson, age 76, passed away Sunday, December 6, at the VA Hospital in Iowa City. A visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. Friday, December 7, at the Chapman Funeral Home in Clarence. From Monticello, Milo Brokaw, age 65, died Monday, November 30, at the Monticello Nursing and Rehabilitation Center. from complications of COVID-19. A celebration of life will be held at a future date in the summer of 2021. The Getch Funeral Home in Monticello has taken Milo and his family into their care. And from Monticello, Ralph G. Muller, age 80, passed away peacefully Saturday, December 5th at St. Luke's Hospital in Cedar Rapids. A visitation will be held from 9:30 to 10:30 a.m. Wednesday, December 9, at the Kramer Funeral Home in Monticello. A Mass of Christian burial will be held at 11 a.m. Wednesday, December 9, at the Sacred Heart Catholic Church in Monticello, Iowa, with burial in the church cemetery. From West Point, Amy C. Menke, age 63, of Danville, formerly of West Point, passed away at 7:03 a.m. Saturday, December 5, at Great River Hospice House in West Burlington, Iowa. Friends may call from noon to 6 p.m. Tuesday, December 8, at the Schmitz Funeral Home in West Point. A memorial service will be held at 11 a.m. Wednesday, December 9, at the Schmitz Funeral Home in West Point. And from Packwood, Melvin Sidney Johnston passed away on Thursday, December 3, at Mercy Hospital in Iowa City from COVID-19 cardiac complications. A private immediate family service will be held, with a celebration of life service to be held at a later date. From Robbins, Dale E. Rich, age 84, died Sunday, December 6, at Emory Place in Robbins. A private family service will be held at the Cedar Memorial Chapel of Memories. The service will be live streamed at 1 p.m. Wednesday, December 9. And from Shellsburg, Nancy P. Grace, age 80, of rural Shellsburg, Iowa, died on Wednesday, December 2, at the Oldorf Hospice House of Mercy in Hiawatha. I don't see any further funeral notifications. Oh, there will be no public services. The White Funeral Home is in charge of arrangements. And from Walker, Eileen Anna Schmitz Knight, age 93, passed away on Friday, December 4, 2020, after a short illness. Public calling hours will be from 6 to 8 p.m. Tuesday, December 8, the Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Center Point. A private funeral mass at Sacred Heart Catholic Church in Walker, and burial will be in the Sacred Heart Cemetery in Walker. And from Montezuma, Louise Darlene Dvorak, age 84, of Montezuma, formerly of Elberon, Iowa, passed away on Friday, December 4, at Care Initiative Center in Montezuma. A service for Louise is at 1 p.m. Thursday, December 10, at Hrabek Newhouse Funeral Service. The service also will be live streamed through the Funeral Home Facebook page. And in other death notices today from Kyoto, James A. Sheets, age 80, died on Saturday, December 5. The Powell Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Kyoto is assisting the family. From Maquoketa, Maxine Rice Stroffer, age 101, died on Friday, December 4. The Carson Celebration of Life in Maquoketa is assisting the family. And from Marengo, Claude Thomas Pierce, age 70, died Saturday, December 5. The Kloster Funeral Home in Marengo is assisting the family. And from Marion, Sarah J. Fischel, age 87, died Sunday, December 6. The Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Marion is helping with arrangements. From McGregor, Lorraine Ayers, age 86, died Friday, December 4. The Thornburg Grau Funeral Home and Cremation Service in McGregor is assisting the family. And from Monmouth, Marlon E. Kramer, Sr., age 86, died Friday, December the 4th. The Carson Celebration of Life Center in Maquoketa is assisting the family. From St. Lucas, Norbert Kunin, age 90, died on Saturday, December the 5th. The Schluter-Balick Funeral Home in Decorah is assisting the family. And from Washington, Beatty L. Hansen, age 91, died Saturday, December the 5th. The Beatty Petersheim Funeral Home in Washington is assisting the family. And as is typical on Monday, we have no prep sports to report on, but there is a story about the Iowa men's basketball team. It's entitled Nunji Emerging as a Vital Player for Iowa. It's a story by Mike Loss of the Gazette staff. We kind of forgot about Jack Nunji. He wasn't able to play in Iowa's first two men's basketball games this season and hadn't played for the Hawkeyes since he tore an ACL in the fifth game of last season, more than a year ago. He had redshirted the season before in his second season in the program. Jack is back. The fourth-year sophomore forward immediately established himself Thursday as a key player in number three Iowa's hopes of doing big things this season. He came off the bench to score 18 points in 19 minutes with the Hawkeyes 99-58 over Western Illinois, making eight straight shots in one stretch. Included were two three-pointers. "That's the guy we look at practice every day," said Iowa senior center Luca Garza, who leads the nation in scoring with 34 points per game. "He plays with that energy and that type of ability to shoot the ball and stretch the floor. He is a really, really good player. A lot of teams got lucky last year when he got hurt." Garza and Nunji came to Iowa in the same recruiting class, a pair of 6'11" players who were part of Fran McCaffrey's rotation as freshmen. Garza finished the 2017-2018 season strong, scoring at least 13 points in Iowa's last six games. Nunji tailed off that season, a common thing for freshmen big men. With the Hawkeyes well-stocked in post players that the following season, with Tyler Cook, Ryan Kreiner, and Garza, Nunji opted to redshirt and work on his game and physique. He started the first five games last season and averaged 12.5 points in the two games preceding his injury. You probably haven't heard a lot about him in the build-up for this season, but the Hawkeyes were ready and eager for his return. "He's been a dominant player in practice for the last 2.5 years, McCaffrey said. "His length defensively, his ability to rebound in traffic, and offensively, he's just as good a passer and ball handler as he is a post-up player and a shooter. So that only makes him really difficult to defend when he is playing either the power forward or the center position, because he's not only going to be on the block, he can make threes. He hits cutters. He posts up. He seals you. He uses his length. He can score over either shoulder. He's a very efficient guy because he plays the game the right way." Iowa's offense in its three games has been top-heavy with Garza. "It's something there, if you take it, and the Hawkeyes have little trouble getting the ball in the post to Garza. But starting with Tuesday night's home game against North Carolina, opponents will be bigger and better, and Garza welcomes Nunji's presence. He helps me tremendously," Garza said after Thursday's game. "When you have a guy who shoots the ball and stretches the floor like that, he gives me more space. As a big, that changes a lot of things. Also, defensively, you saw him tonight blocking shots and contesting every shot at him. He's 6'11", taller than me. He's got the longest wingspan and the neck, and he's a heck of an athlete. We're a different group with him on the floor." And here's your Dear Abby for today. It's entitled, "Chill in Air is Source of Heated Household Debate." Dear Abby, "I'm a 46-year-old woman. My fiancé lives with me and my two children. My issue is I pay all the bills, and he complains about the temperature inside my home. I tell him to put on more clothes if he's cold, but he complains to the point that I turn off the fans and air. My question is, don't I have a right to be comfortable in the home I pay for? That's signed Hot and Frustrated in Virginia." And Abby responds, "The answer is yes, and your fiancé, not you, should invest in a portable heater. P.S. Are you sure you want to be married to this prize? Nowhere in your letter did you say you love this person. Frankly, he seems like a third child." Dear Abby, "I have a job I love. My co-workers are nice, but once I punch out at the end of the day, I want to forget them. I believe that's how it should be. But some of them try to arrange meetups after work to hang out, or they insist on becoming my friend on social media. Is there a nice way to tell these people to back off a little? 9 to 5 in New York. Abby responds, Dear 9 to 5, when you're invited to hang out, explain that you have things you need to do or previous commitments. As for sharing your personal information with them online, all you have to say is that you prefer to keep your business and personal lives separate. Here's your letters to the editor today. First from Ken Bowen of Iowa City. Grassley and Ernst's holdout on election is disrespectful. On November 3, a presidential election was held. One major party candidate won the popular vote and gained a plurality in the Electoral College. The other major party candidate claimed the election was rigged. 1 week later, Joe Biden was declared the winner and the new president-elect. In the weeks since, neither of Iowa's senators have offered the customary congratulations to the president-elect. This reflects poorly on their character. Stop with the partisan politics, congratulate the winners, and work to bring the country together again. That letter by Ken Bowen of Iowa City. And from John Protzman of Coralville, who is suffering from a lack of integrity? The CEO of a corporation and the governor of a state seem to have similar functions. They include making decisions for the betterment of the corporation, or in the governor's case, the betterment of the people who elected him or her. In either situation, the integrity of the position is something the board of directors of a corporation or the electorate of a state need to monitor. If that integrity comes in question for any reason, the board of directors may act by removing the CEO. Does not the electorate of the state have the same responsibility? Governor Kim Reynolds needs to adhere to the same integrity levels by which we Iowans live our own lives. Multiple times throughout this pandemic, we have witnessed strange metrics, glitches in state data, failure to monitor unsafe working conditions, refusal to share public information, under-recording the seriousness and elevated levels of COVID-19, refusal to follow Centers for Disease Control and Prevention guidelines, and the ignoring of suggestions of expert epidemiologists. These questionable behaviors need to be addressed. By whom? GOP state legislators have remained silent and thus complicit. So probably no help is coming from them. The removal of the incompetent governor is left to the general electorate. Seem rather harsh? If someone is negligent in performing his or her duties and many more deaths occur due to said negligence, regardless of the intent, something needs to be done. Our governor is in over her head, but it is the people of Iowa who are drowning, and that by John Protzman of Coralville. From Roger W. Smith of Waterloo, reader takes issues with Hawkeye's helmet decals. It appears that the University of Iowa administration is okay with Black Lives Matter on football helmets. I recommend, for the sake of accuracy and completeness, that the hammer and sickle be affixed to the helmets as well. I assume that now it is acceptable for Christian players to wear a cross and a scripture quotation on their helmets, and for Jewish players to wear a Star of David and a Talmudic quotation, and for Muslim players to wear a crescent and a quotation from the Quran, or not. And if not, why not? Signed, Roger W. Smith of Waterloo. Finally, from Arlie Clemens of North Liberty, Rita Hart thumbs her nose at voters in House District 2. What in the world would ever make Rita Hart think that the Iowans of the 2nd Congressional District cannot elect their own congressional representative? Yes, the vote was close. Yes, the counting process had errors. The vote is final. The vote was certified. If Hart doesn't like the results, she has access to a legal proceeding per Iowa law. Why in the world does she ignore the results and Iowa law? Now she's decided to go to Nancy Pelosi for a political decision. We know why. She's thumbing her nose at Iowa law and the voters of Southeast Iowa. This is ridiculous behavior and will go down in Iowa history as a farce. And from the community page, a new nutcracker spins. Clara, dreaming her way through an Iowa journey, tap dancers battling on the old Capitol steps, and Leslie Nolte choreographing masked flowers waltzing in a vineyard. These are just a few of the peppermint twists in a reimagined nutcracker ballet that isn't all ballet and isn't all on stage. After 15 years of offering a traditional in-person nutcracker for the holidays, Nolte Academy in Coralville and the Englert in Iowa City have produced their first virtual production of the time-honored tale of a young girl whisked through magical adventures. It will stream online Friday night and twice on Saturday. Find details at englert.org/events. The team had more than a few hurdles to dance around before making the leap to film. First and foremost was safety, with more than 100 dancers ages 7 to 18 in the production. Around June, when it became apparent that the Englert wouldn't open by December, Nolte said the answer was to move as much filming as possible outdoors. While physical distancing in open spaces would provide a measure of protection from coronavirus spread, the dancers still had to rehearse, and when the weather turned cold, some scenes would need to move to the Englert for filming. Nolte Academy surveyed dancers and their families about their comfort levels for rehearsals and filming. Some were open to physically distanced, masked rehearsals. Others preferred participating online all the way through. We just knew that for the dancers themselves, they need this annual work, Nolte said. Nolte, age 44, of Iowa City, who owns the studio, has served as producer for the Nutcracker through the years, but hasn't choreographed the show. So she turned to her ballet director, Sarah Barragan, age 42, of Iowa City, for the role of artistic director. She served as rehearsal assistant for last year's Nolte production, but also has staged 10 Nutcracker ballets at her own studio, City Ballet of Iowa, with her husband, Elroy Barragan, who also is a certified screen dance filmmaker. The challenge was to reimagine the show during the pandemic and keep everyone safe. Barragan said her first question was, how do we make this work? In addition to Nolte, the creative team includes tap director Robin Watson, contemporary dance choreographer Riley Villauer, and visual arts director Kyle Powell. Nolte alum Ellison Brown also worked with Barragan on writing the storyline. And then I wanted to include Iowa City because the original Nutcracker story was created in 1892 and has a lot of traditions and storylines that don't apply to who we are today, Barragan said. Because of the separation, I wanted people to see Iowa City. If people are isolating and staying at home, I wanted them to be reminded of the different locations in Iowa City, especially the ones that are affiliated with the arts. But of course, we still have the general story of the Nutcracker. I've turned it into the dream of a local girl and her dreams, aspirations, and hopes. All of the dancers come from Nolte Academy. Barragan chose Zuri Elvira, age 8, of Iowa City to portray Clara, and included her memories and visions of what dance is in a studio in Iowa City and on the stage. Barragan set the outdoor scenes around such iconic sites as Hancher Auditorium and the old Capitol Building, as well as the University of Iowa's Art Building West and city parks containing art pieces. I wanted to make physical art a big part of what we're doing, she said. Nolte set part of her Waltz of the Flowers scene at the Walker Homestead Vineyard in rural Iowa City. As choreographers, we looked around our community and thought, where would dance be beautiful and the storyline be appropriate? So to have my bright pink flowers in the fall columns of the vineyard, it was beautiful, Nolte said. I was super pleased. Part of Nolte's scene also was filmed indoors at the Englert, with the dancers wearing masks, in addition to traditional tutus and toe shoes. The music was recorded on the English stage as well, but without any dancers on stage and without a full orchestra dancing through the familiar Tchaikovsky musical score. In years past, Carrie Bastian of Iowa City has wielded the baton over the Nutcracker Orchestra. Since that wouldn't be safe to do during the pandemic, he and his wife, Mira Kim, the core musicians of Red Cedar Chamber Music, and their sons Oliver and Adrian, performed as a string quartet. It was quite beautiful during the filming of that, Nolte said. It's lovely to be able to still incorporate a piece of the orchestra and our longtime conductor. And here's the at a glance. It's the Nolte Academy and Englert Theater present The Nutcracker 2020, a new filmed production featuring Nolte Academy dancers. It's at 7:30 p.m. Friday, 2, and at 7:30 p.m. on Saturday. And it's online access with ticket package purchase. Tickets are $20 to $250, including sweet treats, individual and family pricing, and donation options at englert.org/events. And that does it for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette. It's Monday, December the 7th. I'm your reader, Ken Lauder, and you can access a recording of today's reading on our website at ioradioreading.org at any time. And thank you for listening.